Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, in the past, I've bragged about being able to see the future a little bit. You know, I've told you that before. Every once in a while, I can get an inkling I can see the future. Well, I'm here to tell you and to really brag right now that I'm coming to our listeners from the future, as are you, because the rest of this podcast after like the first 15 or 20 minutes is going to be something that we taped like 8 hours ago. But now we're here in the moment, the present moment, the future, to talk about Blake Griffin and the insane trade that just broke like an hour after we recorded the first part of our podcast. So let's dig in, man. We got like 15, 20 different angles to jump on this Blake thing. Where do you want to start?
This is great. We have a lot to work through. A couple things I want to mention at the top, a couple things in the rest of the podcast that are now immediately out of date. Number one, we mentioned Avery Bradley as a possibility in Cleveland and OKC, and I don't know. Actually, that's not entirely out of the question after this deal, but it's obviously looking like more of a long shot after he moves to LA. We were talking about the Pistons at one point, and I said that none of their dozens of trade rumors looked at all appealing. And given how ugly the options were, I think the Blake gamble is actually okay for them, but we can come back to that. And then number three, best of all, is we ended the pod with me kind of mumbling to you, like, do we think anything is actually going to happen? And then it turns out that something happened. So let me start by saying that I love this deal for the Clippers. I am very impressed. This was pretty ruthless, first of all, sending Blake to Detroit mere months after signing that deal and recruiting him with the whole jersey in the rafters presentation and whatnot. But, I mean, if we went back to the summer, when Blake re-signed, I was pretty ambivalent about what the Clippers were trying to do. And this makes a lot more sense. I mean, I think that they are now positioning themselves really well for not this summer, but the summer of 2019, when there's going to be a lot of talent available and they'll have all kinds of flexibility. And I don't know. I'm so used to the Clippers kind of just sort of kicking the can down the road that I'm sort of in shock by how smart this deal looks. And I don't know how much credit we give to Jerry West. I know Lawrence Frank is out there too. They've got the new management has done a good job this year. If you look up and down that roster, there's more talent and more sort of strange depth than they've ever had in the Doc era. And so, like, I don't want to overstate it and call this brilliant, because they could easily strike out 2 years from now. But this feels like a step in the right direction for the Clippers. What do you think?
Well, you mentioned feeling in shock, and I hope it's shock, Andrew, because I'm pretty disappointed in you in terms of what you just said. Because if there's one thing, because if there's one thing you've consistently said over like the last 9 months, it is trade Blake, trade Blake, trade Blake, trade Blake. So where is the victory lap here? I mean, can you remember how many times over the course of this season you said, which player do you think is going to get traded first, John Wall or Blake Griffin or Russell Westbrook? I mean, you're always throwing these hypotheticals at me, these, you know, off the wall, they're never going to trade their franchise guy hypotheticals. And yet, here you were, broken clock, right, twice a day, nailing the fact that the Clippers might have some pretty serious buyer's remorse after committing big-time money to Blake Griffin last summer. So, take two here. Pat yourself on the back a little bit. Go for it.
I am, again, as I said, I'm very impressed that they finally came around. And you're right to point out that I have been banging this drum for a while now. I mean, I think my first ever column at Sports Illustrated was a plea for the Clippers to trade Blake Griffin. I think this was like in 2015 or 2016. And they finally did it. I will be honest, though. When I first saw the news, because of the season that John Wall is having in Washington, I have looked into the rules, and you're not allowed to trade a player who just signed a designated player exception deal, Supermax, whatnot. So I thought that Blake had signed one of those deals, and I didn't think he was eligible to be traded. That's the only reason I have cooled on my trade Blake Griffin campaign over the last couple months. But look, this is a great deal. And, you know, I don't want to sound too gleeful about this because the Pistons have reasons to be excited as well. But it also should be a red flag that the team who has been making these short-term plays over and over and over again over the last few years was the one team that was willing to take on Blake. I think that's a sign that the Clippers are probably going to come out looking better when we look back at this 2 or 3 years from now.
Well, look, I am bursting with takes and information, but before I go any further, I want you to know I cooked up a 1 liter batch of Benegrino, you know, my home cooked bubble water that I subsist on, and I'm pouring it to the ground for Blake Griffin. I really feel bad for this guy. I mean, his life is turned upside down and basically ruined. I mean, one day he's hosting Red Bull comedy jams at the Avalon Club in Hollywood, you know, kicking it with the Kardashians, doing his thing. The next day he's in a locker room with Stan Van Gundy, Root Canal Reggie Jackson, and Andre Drummond trying to make it work.
Like, if you're drunk, the current Pistons roster looks like the old Clippers roster, except everyone is just 25% to 30% worse.
Well said. So I want to take you back, Andrew, to a story I briefly told a few months ago. Do you remember when Blake got injured? He had that knee sprain in late November. I was at the Lakers-Clippers game, and I told you how weird it was that he gets injured in the closing minutes of that game. It's clear that it's serious, but then right after the game, Lou Williams had like 42 points, and Steve Ballmer was like pounding him on the back, excited, like, yeah, yeah, let's do it, way to go. Like, he's so excited to get this win over the Lakers, and I was just sitting there thinking, like, man, this is weird. Like, is Ballmer in denial? Like, Blake Griffin could be done for the year here. Like, why isn't he, like, concerned at all? And, you know, on his way out of the arena, Ballmer was like, oh, yeah, now we got to go check on Blake. And it was kind of this matter-of-fact thing. And in hindsight, I think his reaction was kind of emblematic of the Clippers' direction here, their vision. I mean, he's looking at that and saying, we're not Blake's team, the Alpha and the Omega, anymore. I mean, Blake is not the only guy that we have to worry about. And we've been through these injuries so many different times previously that we can't go ahead and freak out when it happens every time again. And so you can understand why, from his perspective and from the front office's perspective, they would feel a little hamstrung, still tying themselves to Blake. And this contract got off to pretty much the worst possible start. You look at how well the Clippers have played with and without Griffin this season. In the first year of the new deal, he's not having a superstar's impact. He's not having the impact of a top five salary player in the league. He's basically having no impact. Their net rating with and without him is virtually identical. Their record with and without him is virtually identical. And they're still kind of stuck in this, like, well, we're trying to play these two bigs, but no one else really plays that way style. And it was never going to get them over the top. So if you're Ballmer or you're Jerry West or you're Lawrence Frank, I mean, to me, you have this series of just kind of pretty straightforward yes or no questions. Like, is Blake good enough to be the guy on a title team? At this point with his injury history, no. Is he living up to his contract at this point, given his availability and given his impact on the court? The answer is no. And then, are you better off reshaping your roster, trying to modernize, trying to go a little bit deeper, trying to take a more flexible approach heading forward, and just sort of let someone else deal with Blake's contract? And I think the answer there is yes. And by the way, these guys were right on the borderline of luxury taxes again this season. So you're asking Ballmer basically to pay through the nose for a team that's sort of average. That rarely happens in the NBA. You hardly ever see a team skirt the luxury tax line when they're only sort of mediocre, around 500, competing for an eighth seed. So, you know, from that standpoint, even though it's a ruthless, cold-blooded, arguably a backstabbing type move to Blake, logically, it is the right move. And I say that as someone who has really enjoyed covering Blake Griffin's last few years here in Los Angeles, a guy who's really enjoyed one-on-one interviews with him over these last couple of years, who has a ton of respect for his style of play and his unique game. The Clippers were right to make a change here.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, even the tweet teasing the deal where Woj tweeted out that the Pistons were in talks to acquire all-star forward Blake Griffin. Like, I did a double take there. I was like, wait a second, Blake's not an all-star, is he? And hasn't been the last few years, and like didn't project to be one over the next few years in the West. I think if you move him to the East, he's actually going to be pretty awesome. But I mean, as you were talking, the thing I kept coming back to is that, like, obviously the Lakers are making moves that may or may not pay off, but they're doing their whole Machiavellian thing with Magic and Palinka, and I love it. But there's a real possibility that the Lakers are going to be back of in some form or another over the next like year or two, and that would sort of push the Clippers back to that little brother role, which you could even argue that they've never really left that little brother role. But the bottom line is, like, keeping Blake Griffin and planning the next 4 years or 5 years around him and sort of like shooting for maybe a sixth seed every year, that was the little brother move. And this is taking things in a new direction, man. And I'm really excited to see, like, you know, Klay is available in the summer of 2019. Kawhi is available in the summer of 2019. Jimmy Butler. And they're going to have a lot of room to kind of get wild here. And, you know, again, the front office knows what they're doing. It's clear, even just watching the team thus far this season, like, there are more pieces than there ever have been. But I think we should flip now because...
No. Slow down.
We've worshipped the Clippers enough. We don't need to continue
No, I want to have a quick comparison here to underline the point that you just made. There was lots of concern from some people that Blake Griffin was at risk of becoming the next Amari Stoudemire, one of these athletic power forwards whose game falls off a cliff once he starts getting to his late 20s, and he's not the same guy, and you're paying this huge money for a superstar who's giving you nothing, and now you're totally stuck, right? That's a possibility for Blake if the injuries continue. But there is another possibility, a very pretty good possibility, and I would argue a better possibility, that Blake just becomes the next Carmelo Anthony, where he's kind of...
I really thought you were about to put a positive spin on everything, and you just somehow made it meaner than Amari, because at least Amari had the knee injuries as an excuse.
No, not at all, because I think that is really how you get stuck, and the Knicks were really stuck because they kind of believed in Melo. They talked themselves into Melo, and the Clippers could have made that mistake. I mean, it's very easy to see... like you're saying, you know, you're chasing the sixth seed year after year. He looks like a star. He puts up some per game stats like a star, so therefore he's a star. But in reality, his impact isn't quite living up to that. And let me just say this. The Knicks could make that work because they're the Knicks in New York. They're the show. The Nets are still the challenger brand. They're across the bridge. You know, people don't really respect them, and they've been a complete mess. Like you're mentioning, the Clippers are competing with the Lakers, so they've already got the Lonzo and all the other hype factor going on there. Even if you look at this year's home attendance, the Clippers have dropped from 10th last season to 20th already this season. That's a big hit. The crowd was really not responding to Blake like they used to, and it was very easy to envision a future where... essentially, you have this disgruntled Staples Center crowd who's kind of over Blake's antics, similar to how you know, the Madison Square Garden crowd was sort of over Carmelo, and it's just kind of a lose-lose for everyone. And you're also mentioning the Clippers front office, and I just want to say quickly, I've spent a decent amount of time with them here over the last couple of weeks for a piece I've been working on. I'm not going to say I'm embedded. That's giving myself too much credit. but one thing you're right about is their changing approach to depth and development. And Lawrence Frank told me in an interview in his office, you know, basically a week or two ago, he said their plan this year was to redefine what being a Clipper meant. They wanted to be a challenger brand in LA because they have so much competition in the market. They have to work harder to prove themselves. And they wanted blue-collar guys with core qualities like competitiveness, high character, hard playing, toughness, basketball IQ, and being a great teammate, right? So that is the exact opposite of we're going to pay three superstars and just try to make the pieces work around them, which is what the Clippers have been for years. And to to complete that transition, to really get to where Frank's vision, you know, is going to be, it's not just about trading away Chris Paul for tough guys like Beverly and Montrezl Harrell and everybody else. It's, you know, sending Blake packing and trying to, you know, put his salary cap space and his number and, you know, his shots and touches to just a different use. And so I think from that standpoint, you're right. The Clippers front office probably didn't rush to the conclusion like it might seem from the outside to people who are shocked by this move. This most likely was months in the making.
Yeah. Can I just say, I love the idea of you bunkered down with Lawrence Frank, just talking hoops and talking development in Los Angeles.
Well, I'll say we talked for an hour. I want to say he had between, I want to say he had in between 14 and 15 espresso shots over the course of an hour. I mean, the guy is an animal. I love it. I really respect him, and we'll see where their franchise goes. But I think anytime you see a trade, like you're mentioning that tweet, and it catches you off guard and Jerry West is involved, at least one degree of separation from the move, the odds are pretty good his fingerprints are all over it, right? I mean, Jerry West is not one to ever worry about emotions, to care for feelings. In his own head, in his own life, he's obviously someone who's dealt with all sorts of you know, tough experiences, but that's a cold-hearted dude who just wants to win, who wants to be a player in free agency and attract star players. And this move, you know, absolutely meshes what we're seeing as Lawrence Frank's vision, but also meshes that with what we know about Jerry West as an executive and as a power player.
Can I ask you something? We've talked about this being a cold-hearted move. I called it a ruthless move 10 minutes ago. Like, the more we talk about it, though, like, it's not that ruthless. And some of the tweets after, look, dude, he is making $175 million, and they paid him that and made sure that he was taken care of. And the idea that, like, I've seen a lot of people say that this is going to mean that every superstar gets a no trade clause in their deal going forward. And it may well mean that, but Blake couldn't get a no trade clause in his deal because everyone knew that he was injury prone and that his body was breaking down when he signed the deal. So that was part of the process and part of the negotiations all along. And I don't know, I think I totally understand, especially when you juxtapose this trade with the July pitch to him with the Pioneer shirt and the video presentation. And like, I think they had like a maze of all his major life events. So it definitely looks bad, but I mean, I think a lot of this is just business, and it's not like Blake had been playing at a discount in LA. So Andrew, I would measure the cold-hearted takes as the Clippers are concerned.
I appreciate your effort to go against the grain, but I really do disagree. I mean, first of all, you laid out their free agency pitch to him. I mean, this is the same organization that has the lottery ping pong balls they used to select him in 2009, framed in a glass case, prominently displayed at their practice facility. So it's like the first thing you see when you go in. They've kind of pitched him as Mr. Clipper. They've got him on all the billboards. Right. He's the center of the marketing campaign. You remember when they had that crazy tunnel incident with the Rockets where Chris Paul and all these guys are supposedly getting in a fight? Well, who was the guy the very next day who was meeting with the elementary school kids, like shaking hands and taking pictures as part of, you know, the community service program?
All right. If you're going to bring the elementary school trips into it.
No,
sure.
I'm serious. This is his role with this team. This guy has been synonymous with the Clippers, and this was a trash brand. I mean, this was a guy who went through all that nonsense with Donald Sterling for years. He is instrumental in bringing this franchise to where they have been, to their little golden era here over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. It's cold-hearted in that light, period. And I've already been hearing from people, Blake's not happy about this at all. I've already heard that. And from that standpoint, like, it wasn't like there was a typical superstar conversation where you say, hey, man, like, we respect everything you've done for us, so we're thinking about shopping you. Do you have any places you'd like to go? There is no way Detroit ever comes up in that scenario? And I challenge you this. I mean, $175 million or not, would you like to take the same salary and move halfway across the country, uprooting your family to a cold weather climate after living in one of America's yes. premier cities for a decade? Would you really want to
yes.
do that? Come on.
Yes. And I'm not, look, I'm not trying to be the internet commenter who is like, oh, he's making $25 million a year. I'd do that. Like, I can live with that. I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm just saying this is not as egregious a situation as like Isaiah Thomas with the Celtics, especially when you consider the context in which he signed that initial deal. I think if you're Blake, you have to be going in clear-eyed knowing that this is at least a possibility. Although,
that's a good point. Good point.
So I don't know. It's fine. I also well, just read that the new tax code, because of the new tax code and Michigan's 4% state tax rate compared to California's 13% rate, Blake is going to save a lot of money. So good news already. The Detroit era of his career is already off to a good start. And we should talk for a few minutes about the Pistons.
Yeah, there's one more good piece of news for him is like, if you know, in between your condo search, Blake, go ahead and check out the Dearborn Inn. It's a fantastic hotel. I've mentioned it before. It's not too far outside the city. You can be right there where Henry Ford's private airfield used to be, right near the Ford manufacturing plants. Maybe you could take a tour, really get in touch with the heartland and you know, the blue collar vibe in that area. Check it out. Also, great halal food right up the street. Highly recommended.
So, speaking of Detroit, speaking of the Dearborn Inn, the Pistons side of this, I think there are two ways to grade what Detroit is doing. I think if you look at the last 3 years of Pistons moves, obviously things have not worked out particularly well. Stan Van Gundy's actually won a decent amount of his trades. The problem is that he has an affinity for players who are not actually very good. And I'm going to put Reggie Jackson in that category. I'm going to put that. I would even put Tobias Harris in that category, no matter how much basketball Twitter will say, like, he's having the best year of his career. He's really turned a corner. Like, they acquired him and were like, okay, now we have our wing of the future. And if he's the wing of the future, there's a ceiling on what you can be as a team. And that has been true for most of the moves that Stan Van Gundy has made. However, I think that given where they are now, rolling the dice on Blake is not the worst play in the world. It's definitely more likely to look bad in 3 or 4 years than it is to look brilliant. But I think there's a chance that if you put him in the East, I mean, right now, he's probably one of the 7 best players in the East, maybe even higher on that list. And you know, like, I think this is going to make them more fun to watch going forward. They still have to figure out something to do with root canal Reggie Jackson. He's still a problem. But I'm more interested in watching Pistons games than I have been in the last 2.5 years.
Would you say 25 years or 2.5 years? No, just kidding. Yeah, no. Look, this is it's a different style for them. I mean, even when the Pistons were good, they've always sort of played a certain way. And I think when you have Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond now, who sort of unlocked some of his passing ability, it could get kind of weird. I mean, I love big-to-big passing. No surprise. I'm a big San Antonio Spurs honk, and they were all about that. You could see some of that. I'm just worried that spacing, cramping is going to be a big time issue there. And I'm also frankly worried about where Blake's head's going to be at, you know? And like I said, I'm a big Blake Griffin defender, but you throw a guy a curveball like this and you put him in a situation where they're outside the playoff picture in the East, you put him in a conference where they don't have enough to gun with the top three teams at all. And, you know, it's almost like it's going to be a mental test for him. You know, is he going to bring it night in, night out down the stretch of the season? You know, I'm sure he's been dealing with stuff health-wise, kind of in and out of the lineup here at various points. How is that going to play out? Are you still going to kill yourself for your new team like you tried to for years for your old team? It's an open question. That's not like a character assassination on Blake Griffin. That's just human nature. And you look at their other pieces. I mean, I don't see a lot of fits happening in Detroit. Well, I see Stan Van Gundy just like, move, just trying to like stay ahead of the haters and stay ahead of the critics by just constantly doing something new and different. And I think he might have backed himself into a corner on this one. I think I mean, you never want to say a guy's untradeable. And I made the assumption that Blake probably wouldn't be traded because of how big his contract was once. But
right.
You know, we could be in a situation where now Detroit is overseeing that late career Melo vibe. And, you know, it's not going to play any better in Detroit than it did in LA because, you know, the fans up there have really been struggling to turn out and get excited for that franchise for, you know, the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah, I like Reggie Bullock. That's my only take on the rest of the Pistons roster. It's not great, but decent curveball for them. I would give the trade a B considering where the Pistons are and what their options were going forward, but I give it an A for the Clippers. Regardless of what happens, again, we're not saying that they're going to go out and like suddenly be the next team to beat the Warriors, but I think their future makes a lot more sense now. And let's close it out with a couple more questions here. Do you think Avery Bradley gets moved before the deadline?
It's hard to say. I would kind of lean towards them keeping Bradley potentially because they're still in the playoff mix. Like, this is not your typical superstar dump trade where if you do plug right. in quality minutes from Avery Bradley and Tobias Harris, I mean, you can get the eighth seed and call the season a win anyways, right? So I'm not sure they're going to be in a rush to move him. I think that they traded for him in part because of his contract. I mean, it's flexibility. And, you know, Austin Rivers has been dealing with all sorts of injury issues. Bradley kind of plugs in there, gives you another look. And obviously there's the Doc factor too. So to me, their options are wide open at the deadline. They can sell everybody off if they want and really retool things, or they could make the playoff push here. And, you know, from that standpoint, you know, I'm kind of split. I guess I'm leaning towards them keeping him if you put a gun to my head, but I could be talked into a trade for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I like most about this is the whatever happens to Avery Bradley is going to be a clear litmus test for how much power Doc still has in LA, because you know he is just dying to coach Avery Bradley one more time. But if they move him, that's how you know that Doc is really on the way out there. And I do think that teams are going to call and see what they can do. And again, as you'll hear later in the pod, Avery Bradley is going to be attractive to a bunch of different contenders, merely in theory. Like, the reality of Avery Bradley has been a little rough this year, but I think he can still help some teams.
Well, while we're on the subject of asking questions, I got a question for you about this trade. In terms of which teammate pairings are the most likely to get in a fist fight a la Bobby Portis and Nikola Mirotic, where do you rank Blake Griffin and Reggie Jackson? And again, I'm not supporting violence of any kind. I'm just simply pointing out the volatile personalities and the high potential that these guys rub each other the wrong way. Because if you're Blake, you've already dealt with a point guard who was 5 times better than Reggie Jackson and now in Chris Paul for years and years and years. And now you have to listen to this lesser version be just as demonstrative and just as difficult and not playing nearly as well. And then on the flip side, you're Reggie Jackson. You thought you were the guy in Detroit for like a solid 6 months there. And now you're definitely not.
Well, look, Reggie has been coming to grips with that reality over the last year and a half. And if he doesn't get it by now, it's his issue. I think I've seen too many people shorting Blake Griffin's stock over the last hour or two in between finding out about the trade and hopping on here. So I am done with Blake Griffin pessimism. I think that he is going to be better than people expect. And so I'm not going to predict a fist fight in the locker room, but you're right to at least acknowledge the possibility that this turns into an absolute disaster. And it's pretty funny with the protections on that pick. I think it's protected 1 through 4. Like, the Pistons are in a tough spot because this could go really bad, but I don't think there's any way it's going to go like top 4 pick bad. So there's a real possibility that they like the season falls apart and they're picking like 7th in June and have to send that pick to LA, which would be pretty brutal.
Buy your season tickets now, Detroit area residents.
Really didn't intend for this to come off that negative about the Pistons. Last question. What about DeAndre? Okay, am I wasting my time working the trade machine, finding ways to get DeAndre Jordan to DC?
Well, I'm going to be just straight up ego waffling on you two questions in a row that you've asked. But look, you can make the case that you trade Blake away, so now you've got money potentially to re-sign DeAndre this summer. And if you had one guy who's easier to build around than the other, you can make that case. You can flip side and say, okay, you trade Blake away, so what's the point of DeAndre? You're going to completely retool. So therefore, you cash out on DeAndre and really add to your pick stockpile, open things wide open for, free agents going forward. I could see it both ways.
Yeah, I think that if you're the Clippers, the idea of re-signing DeAndre does not make a ton of sense this summer. I think the most interesting question for teams trading for him is going to be whether you think he's going to opt in. And looking at the market, the only teams I could see giving him big money and the type of security that would make it worthwhile to opt out of $25 million next year, I could see Phoenix potentially doing it, and I could see LA doing it. But it's hard for me to find another team.
Why do you think he's opting in?
Well, I don't think that the market is going to be there. There are not many teams with cap space. I mean, Dallas is one. I don't think he's going to go back down that road with Mark Cuban. I think those bridges have been burned. And Phoenix, maybe. I think Phoenix would probably throw more money at a guy like Clint Capella than they would DeAndre Jordan. And so, I
don't know. I think it's a virtual certainty that he opts out just because, you're getting multiple years contracts. You're always going to take that security.
But who is going to pay him?
Someone will eventually. This is an all-NBA center who's, 28, 29. I mean, someone will find the way to make it work. And I think if you're the Clippers, you have some level of interest in doing that. I mean, you need to have somebody to play that spot. It's a very, very important position in terms of winning. And when you're ranking the guys who are the most important to the Clippers' success this season, you would probably start with Lou Williams, and I wouldn't necessarily argue with you on that one. And Chris Paul was the one who called out Blake Griffin, and I thought he was out of turn to do that. But you could argue that Blake was the third most important player for the Clippers this season, with DeAndre being either first and second. So let's not write him out of L.A. as a useless player.
Yeah, I don't think he's useless at all, but I also think that the Blake trade, especially right now, as the Clippers are really starting to play well and push for a playoff spot, I think this signals that the Clippers are dreaming bigger and angling for something bigger in 2 years. And I don't think that DeAndre fits into that version of the future. But and mostly, I've just spent the last 30 minutes on the trade machine, and I think Jason Smith, Marcin Gortat, Kelly Oubre in a first would be a nice haul for them. Both Gortat and Jason Smith are up in 2019, and Oubre is a nice little wing for them. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll revisit it later in the week.
From a selfish standpoint, I'll take Gortat and Boban as the number 1-2 punch for quotes in the locker room. If that's what I've got to settle for, if I have to watch a lottery team, at least you can give me that. But Andrew, I think we should segue now into the rest of the podcast that we taped earlier today, discusses all sorts of mailbag questions and other stuff, right?
Yeah, we talked through the Boogie injury. We talked through OKC. We threw around some random trade ideas. So look forward to that. Ben and I will be back on Friday. And this is great. Thank you for doing this, Ben. And thank you for the NBA, or thank you to the NBA for never being boring. This is fun.
Why are we thanking each other again? Let's just get to it.
I don't know. Sounds good. We have to talk about Boogie, and we have to talk about Roberson. So let's start in New Orleans. Jake says, the Pelicans were a firm sixth seed in the West, comfortably above 500, and just took down the undefeated version of the Rockets with Harden, Capella, and Chris Paul out there. It seemed through all the injury and adversity, the Pellies were finally proving all the haters and the critics wrong. Now that Boogie is down and out, what's next in New Orleans? And the thing is, when that injury hit, NBA Twitter did their thing where suddenly it was like Boogie had fallen in battle, and there were 12 hours of just crazy melodramatic tributes to him. But the more I thought about it, the more I understood why it was so dark because it really is like any angle of this story you want to focus on, this is just really bad news. Like, I know you wrote about it over the weekend. So what jumped out to you as far as what this injury really means?
Yeah, I don't know why you give me these like disclaimers, like we don't want to get too dark, when the first thought that I want to just let out is that this is an atomic bomb on their season. I don't know if you can get
it's
much darker than that.
Like, this is really the worst possible scenario for them.
So look, coming into the season, I think generally speaking, if you build your franchise around two guys, one guy goes down, even the most casual fan would understand, okay, they're really, really up a creek without a paddle. That's just, you know, simple math, right? But sometimes you can look at the advanced numbers and really put a finer point on that general conclusion. And so bear with me here, Andrew, because Alvin Gentry this year was coaching for his job. He wasn't stupid. He was going to play his best guys. He was going to go down with his superstars. So Anthony Davis leads the league in guys who have played the most games with 40-plus minutes. And as we know, nobody really does that anymore. I mean, that's kind of considered, you know, poor form in this modern day and age to play 40 minutes.
Especially DeMarcus, for someone like him. Like, just Anthony Davis is not Joel Embiid, but he's closer to Joel Embiid than Giannis. And like, he's the last superstar or the last all NBA talent who should be playing 40 minutes a game.
Exactly. And then DeMarcus Cousins is top 10 in the same category as well, right? So what that tells you is the Pelicans pretty much always had either Davis or Cousins on the court for most of the season this year. Now, let me drop a knowledge bomb on you. When both of those guys were on the bench prior to Cousins' injury, all other lineups, any lineup that you want to put together of the Pelicans' kind of misfit players, whether it's, you know, Holiday, Etuan Moore, right down the list, any five-man lineup group that they had together posted a minus 20 net rating. So anytime both those guys were off the court together, they were getting absolutely run off the court. Now, here's the problem. Now you can't put Cousins on the court anymore. So you put the situation now for Davis where you probably have to play him even more minutes if you're Alvin Gentry, if you're trying to save his job. And you look at the first game without Cousins, boom, Anthony Davis plays 41 minutes in a loss to the Clippers. And it puts Davis into this situation where he has to be the hero every single night. And then when he goes to the bench, everything is very likely to crumble night after night. That is going to be the rhythm, I think, for the rest of their season. So you translate that from an implication standpoint, their playoff spot is absolutely in jeopardy. You look at the Clippers over the last month and a half, they've been making, you know, real positive strides, gaining momentum. They're above 500 as we speak in the ninth seed. I could easily see New Orleans falling to that ninth seed. But you know, the other implication is, I think what you're getting at is Davis's treatment. How much is going to be too much? At what point can a coach who's been on the hot seat for multiple seasons relax and only play Davis, you know, a more reasonable number of minutes when he has nothing else to work with? And that's why, to me, it's kind of a ticking time bomb. And then there's one more layer on top of that, which is their GM's been on the hot seat too. The trade deadline's coming up. Is he going to make a move here that is a short-term type move aimed to stabilize and bring in some talent and kind of give them a chance to hold on to that playoff spot, even though it would probably be, you know, seventh or eighth? Or, you know, is he going to do that to save his own job? Or is he going to take a longer-term approach and do what's in the best interest of the organization? You know, either way, it's kind of dark, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if they try to get in the mix here and make another mistake like they've been doing here for the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, and it's at this point, it's actually hard to say what's in the best interest of the organization, because you could make a case that winning now is the only chance you really have at keeping Anthony Davis, and that he's not, like, Anthony Davis is not willing to waste the next 2 years of his prime and wait around for a contender that may or may not come together in 2021. Like, that's not happening. But I think if you're looking at how the Pelicans got here, so much of it does come back to that short-term thinking, like going back 4 or 5 years, because I think with Anthony Davis, he was so good so early that everyone in that organization knew what they had, knew that he was a generational star. And I don't want to say they panicked, but I think it affected the way they built that team. And it almost, it reminded me of LeBron's first run in Cleveland, where the management just sort of got whatever talent they could find. They brought in Antoine Jameson, they brought in Shaq, they brought in Larry Hughes for $80 million. Like, there were just a lot of real questionable decisions, and that same pattern has played out in New Orleans over and over again. I mean, like, Tyreek Evans was probably there, Larry Hughes, but they've made a lot of sort of short-term outlook moves, and it's got them in a spot where, like, I was watching them against the Clippers yesterday, and it's amazing. When you take Boogie off the court, like, they're counting on Dante Cunningham, they're counting on Darius Miller, they're like, half their team are guys who, if you asked even a basketball fan whether they were in the NBA, a lot of people would have no idea. And so that's it, they're in a rough spot. But to me, the worst part about that injury is with Boogie individually, because I think the most frustrating aspect of his career has been that we've never really gotten a chance to see how he responds in a winning situation. And all the losing situations, like, he shares some blame for what went wrong in Sacramento. And over the past few years, like, I've begun to see more of what the critics are talking about, just as far as Boogie's body language, his conditioning, the defense, some of the lazy shots he'll settle for. Like, there were definitely red flags. But having said that, he's also had stretches this season where he's just been unbelievable. And we've never really seen him with a chance to succeed, like a spot where we could definitively say, okay, great, here's his chance to really answer the critics. And now, like, part of me worries that we never will, because the history with Achilles injuries is pretty dark. And like, people were throwing out Elton Brand comparisons over the weekend. There aren't many examples of guys who have come back and been the same player they were.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, this was the best season of DeMarcus Cousins' career, you know, basically period, in terms of translating his individual success to team success. And this was the best season in a decade for the Pelicans, potentially. And both of those are gone up in smoke. Now, you mentioned the comparisons between, like, LeBron James's first Cavaliers run and Anthony Davis's run here in New Orleans. I mean, it's even darker than that comparison, because, you know, in Cleveland, at least they're getting post-prime Shaq. I mean, in New Orleans, they're settling for post-happiness Omer Asik, which is, you know, as bad as it gets. Yeah. The other thing I'd say, just to add another layer of darkness to it, I mean, Boogie is a free agent. You know, this guy was, according to Mark Stein of the New York Times, was on track to get a five-year, $175 million contract this summer. Now, they're going to have to come to terms on that contract, presumably, before he's 100% healthy, because they have essentially 5 months or so until, you know, they're going to have, you know, July 1 free agency opens. So you're going to have some information on Cousins' progress, but not total information. And, you know, if you're the Pelicans, I mean, on one side, this sort of works as an excuse. You know, if you were worried about paying Cousins in any way, if you had any holdups or whatever, you know, this gives you a little bit of an out from a PR standpoint. But at the same time, you had so much trouble getting talent down there in the first place, you might be tied to him, and you just paid Holiday an awful lot of money. Can you pay Cousins less than Holiday, even if he's coming off an injury? I don't think so. So this could turn into a situation where Davis is now being surrounded by Holiday, who might be the most overpaid point guard in the league, and Cousins, who, depending on his health, could wind up being one of the most overpaid centers in the league as well. That 12 months fast forward from where we are today, it could actually be darker at that point in terms of Davis's chances to do anything meaningful on his current contract in terms of playoff success and so forth than it is right now, and that's a scary thought.
Yeah, man, it'll be interesting to see what direction they go, because on the one hand, like you mentioned, there's now a built-in excuse for Gentry, for Dell Demps. Like, everyone down there can point to this Boogie injury, rightfully so, by the way, and say that this is where the season unraveled. Like, watching the Pelicans on Sunday, it was hard. Like, you could see there was not a lot of life in that team. And I'm sure some of that will come back, but they were just kind of dazed. And it was a reasonably close game in the fourth quarter against the Clippers, but there's only so much you could do at this point. But the other direction things could go is I could absolutely see someone coming to their senses among the ownership group down there. And it's hard to know who exactly is in charge, but I could see them sort of cleaning house with the coach, with the GM, bringing someone new in, and then whoever they hire to come in and run that team could absolutely look around and say, all right, the clock is ticking. It's time to move Anthony Davis and start a new era. This is not going to work. The damage is done. And they could see what they can get from there. That's a real possibility, and it wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing in the world, because like you said, the alternate scenarios are not, the future is not that bright, even if you're bringing back Boogie. Although, I don't know, I hope they pay him. I think that's probably how this ends. One more thing on New Orleans. Miguel says, how much do you think Ainge would be willing to offer the Pelicans for AD? The Jays and a first rounder. I didn't know we were calling Jalen and Jason Brown or Jason Tatum Jays.
We're not yeah. calling him that.
I don't think we should. How close do you think he is to picking up the phone to call them right now? I think that the Celtics are going to wait until June to really make that move and start carpet bombing the Pelicans management with offers every hour. But I just want to say my favorite thing on the internet right now is Celtics fans claiming they wouldn't trade Jason Tatum for Anthony Davis. Like, at least once a week, there's a pocket of Twitter that starts having this debate, and there are always Celtics fans who pop up in the mentions of some writer saying, you know, like, if you look at their ceiling, Jason Tatum is going to be awfully close, and I'm pretty sure he's untouchable. It's just the fucking best. So I hope Celtics fans keep that going all year, regardless of what happens with Anthony Davis.
Careful, Andrew. Don't forget, Elizabeth is listening. Now, in terms of your point, I mean, my favorite thing on the internet right now is these hilarious writers who are saying that Team LeBron, with LeBron, KD, and this Anthony Davis amazing player you're describing, aren't going to be able to take out Team Steph. I mean, that is my favorite
we'll
thing.
We'll see. We'll settle these, that these one in LA, man.
Okay.
But yeah, do you think, if you had a guess right now, is Anthony Davis on the Celtics in 2 years?
I don't know. Why do we do this, man? Like, this, we're in the mourning period here for DeMarcus Cousins, okay, and this bothers me. And it actually morally offends me that you're asking this question. And when I said earlier I didn't know who has more decency, Rob or you, I was I was fronting. Okay, Rob's got more decency.
Rob, you were being polite. You were being decent. Good for you.
Yeah. Rob would not ask that question. It's just not time for it. And look, let's see how this Davis experiment goes down the stretch, because don't forget, Andrew, earlier this season, he was squawking a little bit to Woj. You know, he had that piece where he was starting to say, hey, I don't know if they are going to trade me. I don't know what's happening here. He was laying some breadcrumbs. The next 3 or 4 months could be very, very dark for him, or he could wind up being the hero that carries them to the playoffs. I think that this stretch is absolutely critical to determining the answer to your question, which is, you know, long-term, you know, what's going to happen with him. So all eyes on New Orleans, even though Cousins isn't on the court anymore.
Okay. Let's move to the other awful injury from this weekend. What do you think OKC does from here with Roberson? Because there's a part of me, like, I'm upset as a fan of Boogie with, like, what happened in New Orleans, but I also never took the Pelicans seriously. OKC was starting to play really, really, really well over the last 6 weeks or so. And especially since Roberson got back, like, the defense was clicking. The offense has been better as Russ has sort of reined in some of his bad, lazy three-point shooting. And, like, now I don't know what to make of the Thunder going forward. I'm going to see them in D.C. on Tuesday night. But where do they go from here? Because I feel like they now should make a deal to try and replace him.
Well, I think, first of all, I never wish injuries upon any player at any time. But if there's a silver lining of an injury like Roberson's injury, it's that, you know, casual fans like yourself who love the bucket getters, who love mocking the guys who can't do anything on offense, have to come to terms with those Roberson-type player's impact on winning and losing. And there's no question he's had a huge impact for them. If he's played 15 minutes...
With Roberson real quick, the reason I've come to terms with it is because it's so obvious. Like, they are just a completely different team with him guarding the perimeter.
There's no question. When he's played 15 minutes or fewer, their record this season is 6-8. Overall, they're 30-20, so that's a big, you know, spread. When you look at their defensive rating, when he's on the court, it's 12 points better than when he's off the court. And he's also a huge part of their identity. I mean, as much as we talk about Russ stepping up his offense and kind of pulling them out of the muck that they were in earlier this season, Roberson, George, and Steven Adams as a defensive trio, just a solid group, smart, tough, up in your jersey, disciplined, quick hands, physical, all of those attributes apply to all three of those guys. That was the Thunder's identity to me. And taking him off that basically, you know, compromises their identity and really takes away any chance they have in terms of, you know, truly contending. Now, the issue for Oklahoma City is financial. I mean, they were already up against it, you know, paying Melo, paying Russ, you know, trying to make sure you can pay Paul George. You know, they already have Steven Adams on the book. That's a lot of big time salary slots already in place. That will absolutely limit what they're able to do at the trade deadline in terms of targeting a replacement for Roberson. And I think, frankly, anyone they're going to be able to find with the limited trade assets and the limited financial flexibility they have is going to probably wind up being something of a disappointment for Thunder fans.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you think they go after Avery Bradley? Avery Bradley, the idea of him is going to be really attractive to five or six different contenders around the league. But, I mean, one of the problems with OKC, and it's going to be really interesting to see what Presti does, is like they don't really have assets to trade. I don't think they have a pick in this June's draft, or they don't have a first. And, Terrence Ferguson has actually been pretty solid for them early on. He's shown some flashes and could have some trade value. But he's also a cost-controlled asset for the next 4 or 5 years. He's on a rookie deal, and I don't know if Presti is going to be willing to give that up in a deal.
I love that you're dropping cost-controlled asset now. This is getting good. I love it, Andrew.
Taking a lot of caffeine this afternoon.
One thing I'd say about Avery Bradley is I have seen the same debate that you're talking about raging in terms of is he really this elite guy? If his defensive real plus minus has kind of said that, you know, he hasn't been on that level these last couple of seasons. And even if, you know, his impact in Detroit doesn't seem to be quite as big. I mean, the one advantage to him is that he's only making $8 million. So at least you could potentially trade for him. And he's actually a guy before the season started that I had kind of circled as someone who didn't necessarily seem like a long-term fit in Detroit for me, just, you know, based on, you know, Stan's kind of wheeling and dealing. It felt like it was kind of a plug-and-play thing after the whole Kentavious Caldwell-Pope thing kind of blew up in their face a little bit. So they may be able to get a little package together to get a guy like Bradley, but I believe they're out multiple future first-round picks, which is going to complicate things. And again, how much do you want to invest in this year's team?
That's the question, right?
I mean, you don't have that championship ceiling.
Yeah, even if you bring in Avery Bradley, I don't know if that's enough to beat the Rockets. So if you're not going to even win a second-round series, what are you really doing? I'll say this before we move on. My current dream for the trade deadline, and this is it's probably a sign that we care too much about basketball because this isn't that wild a dream, but I would like Avery Bradley to get to Cleveland somehow. I think it would be fun if the Cavs traded Isaiah to Detroit for Avery Bradley, and they would give the Pistons a couple months of a flyer on Isaiah to see what they have there and see if they want to pay him. And then it would give the Cavs someone to not only guard Steph if they make it to the finals, but the Cavs are going to need someone to guard Kyrie too. And watching Avery Bradley in a revenge series against Boston would be a lot of fun. And then the OKC dream I have is a little trickier, but because I don't know if Miami would do it, but I would be calling them every day to try to get Justice Winslow onto the Thunder. And Terrence Ferguson is a guy who I think like I would trust the Heat to turn him into a legit factor over the next couple of years. And for people who don't know, Ferguson was supposed to go to Arizona and wound up going to Australia, and was like, I think, 21st in the draft this past year. But he's been pretty solid. He's very athletic and he can shoot. And that's exactly the type of player that the Heat have been maximizing over the last couple of years. And then Winslow like could be kind of a Roberson guy who can guard either wings or guards, like just throw him out there. I mean, obviously he's not as good as Roberson, but that would be more fun to me than trying to talk myself into Avery Bradley on the Thunder.
I think Miami would want a little bit more, but I have a funnier trade idea for you. Just, I want to get your instant reaction because I just pulled this up on the trade machine.
Okay.
What if Oklahoma City sends Carmelo Anthony to Detroit for Avery Bradley and Reggie Jackson?
I don't think Reggie is welcome back at OKC. I think he's burned too many bridges down there. We'll never know exactly what happened, but everyone associated with that team seems to hate him. But yeah, man, look, why not? That would be another a wild card. If OKC suddenly puts Melo on the table, that would be the ultimate heel turn for Presti. I would be into it. And you're right. Miami, I don't know what they're going to do with Justice Winslow, because like if I were the Heat, I would try to save him for a potential trade for like a real star. I don't think they would be happy talking themselves into Terrence Ferguson's upside. But at some point, they have to make a call there, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen guys like Roberson or even Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, when it comes time for that second contract, those guys don't really get paid because of their glaring offensive problems. So if you can just keep him around on a fairly, you know, affordable contract going forward through his 20s, and he turns out to be a solid player for you, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world from the Heat's perspective. My fake trade would team up real Melo and mini Melo, Tobias Harris, as a great 1-2 punch in Detroit. It would have... It would have the Reggie Jackson reunion, like you mentioned, you know, just to really bring the best out of Westbrook on a nightly basis with their practice battles. And then it would also plug in Avery Bradley, you know, into that Roberson hole. To me, this is a perfect trade. The only downside is Melo has a no trade clause. And I think the NBA designed no trade clauses precisely so people wouldn't have to go to the Pistons. So that could be a problem.
Yeah, it's funny when you start talking through the various Piston scenarios, a little bit like New Orleans, there aren't many positive outcomes from them for them because of some of the decisions that have been made over the last few years. It's just every avenue is pretty dark. But let's move on here to some more trade questions. Although I want to begin with a Vince Carter question. Jason says, injuries to Andre Roberson and Boogie are creating more conversations about how much each of these guys will be missed and how people didn't properly appreciate what these guys were bringing to the table for their respective teams every night. In short, all of this has had me thinking about who I might underappreciate myself. The name that kept coming to mind for me was this week's birthday boy, Vince Carter. Somehow, I feel like I never really appreciated his full skill set, what he brought to the court every night, and the overall impact he had on the league. Are there any other players that you guys maybe feel you underappreciate? Well, I would say I underappreciate guys like Andre Roberson pretty chronically. Vince, though...
Hey, like, look at this. What a great announcement. I appreciate that.
Yes, it's a blind spot of mine. Vince Carter, I will say, was my gateway to the NBA. Growing up, he was the first guy who made me check box scores every day and like really sort of brought me into it. And there was one year I went to Carolina basketball camp, and he spoke at the camp. And one of the most vivid memories, I think I was like 12 years old, was him walking across the court, and he took like a one-legged half-court shot. And it was, and just drained it. And it was like a flick of the wrist for him. And I was just like, holy shit, NBA players are really good. And then like I do feel like he's underappreciated. Although there's another side to that argument where like he's gotten a lot of soft focus treatment late in his career. And like the middle portion of his career was crazy frustrating because he just started settling for jumpers, stopped attacking the rim, and kind of became a little bit soft. And maybe that's one of the reasons he's still playing at 40, is he was smart enough to realize like that's one way to extend his career. But big picture, I think history will remember Vince really, really fondly.
Yeah, it was cool that he skipped a playoff game to go to that camp with you. I think
just, that was hard just to play at the time. It was hard for me.
Just play. Look, I'll be up front. I was never really a Vince stan in any way.
Yeah.
So I think I'm with the emailer that says I probably underappreciated his total body of work. Yeah, in addition to Vince as being a guy I kind of, you know, overlooked or underrated, I mean, there's a few other guys. I would say right now, you know, a player like Kyrie Irving, I probably underrated a little bit in Cleveland, just giving most of the credit to LeBron in that situation. And I think the other type of player that I tend to, you know, potentially underrate is a guy like Andre Drummond, where he's not trendy. You know, there's not a lot of people who are playing like him, but what he's able to do on the court, he does very, very well. You know, he's a league leader in numerous categories. Does that necessarily translate to winning? Does that make him like a top five player in the league? No, it doesn't. But those are the kinds of players where they're cutting against the grain, and I'm just kind of like, eh, whatever. It's not going to be good enough to beat Golden State, so I don't care. That's a very natural blind spot, I think, for an analyst to overlook or underrate guys. But, you know, historically, I think, you know, these guys are going to have to prove it. You know, how much did they win over the course of their careers? I think that's going to be an open question. And I think ultimately when we're looking at players like Vince and others, you know, it settles probably where it should. I think he's going to get the credit he deserves. You know, he's going to be a Hall of Famer. He's got the longevity angle. The bad feelings have mostly gone away. And so I think from that standpoint, he's doing all right for himself.
Yeah. And Vince, I guess in a vacuum, Vince would probably be a borderline Hall of Famer. But I think so many people have fond memories of like the first phase of his career. And then the latter half of his career has also been great as he's sort of adapted and aged gracefully. And I think that's going to be enough to get him in. And really, like, if we want to be real about it, he should be in for his dunks alone, because it was just like nothing we'd ever seen before. So that's where I come down. Put him in because of the 2001 dunk contest, and let people bitch about it if they're upset. Although I will say, in general, NBA fans are better at, like, by the end of everyone's career, we find ways to like guys. There aren't many people who go down as being, like, I guess Dwight Howard will be someone that no one really remembers that fondly. But he'll probably get voted in anyways. And anyways, moving on
here. And just wait till Dwight's on a players-only broadcast on NBA TV, yucking it up, and people will start coming around to him too. You know, it happens.
Yeah, for sure. So the reason I mentioned Vince there and included Jason's question is because we had another question from Mike Pizza, who says, as the Kings look to move on from veterans, do you think the Raptors could make a move for Vince? He could be pretty useful for them as a wing player in crunch time who could be another bucket getter, and they could really limit his minutes otherwise. So I don't know quite how useful Vince can be for the Raptors at this point, in part because I haven't watched a ton of Kings games, but I will say I love this move. Someone brought it up to me in like November on a radio show, and I've been in on it ever since. And if the Raptors, the guy I would pursue if I were the Raptors is Tyreek Evans. And I think that he's a piece who would work in Boston, who would work in Cleveland potentially, and could help them off the bench so that they always have like either Lowry and DeRozan or Tyreek and DeRozan. One of those combos is always on the floor for them. That could be really healthy. But if there are no obvious moves that can sort of bolster the bench, then yeah, go get Vince. Just like, it's a happy ending. I think everybody would be rooting for that to work out.
Yeah, everybody but me. You know, I usually hate these reunion stories. You're like, oh, perfect. Kevin Garnett's going back to Minnesota. Woo woo, here we go. You know, and
but
it
look,
almost always
Vince can still
it almost
help
always
them with
busts
shooting.
Out. Yeah. Well, I think in terms of fit, you know, Tyreek Evans or Vince Carter, if those are my options, I would take Vince Carter there because they've committed to this ball movement stuff and they're trying to keep it moving.
Good point.
And look, Evans is a pounder and he's got crazy blinders. You know, it's just he's got one idea on his mind every single time down the court. And I think that that would kind of, you know, rub the wrong way with what the Raptors are trying to do right now. I think Vince would be a pretty natural fit. Again, it's one of those things where if you ask Raptors fans 5 or 6 years ago, hey, you know, should we bring Vince back? They're probably still in like that jersey burning phase after how he left. But, you know, I'm not going to begrudge Vince if he wants that. You know, I think he's got enough juice in this league to make that happen if he wants to. The Kings aren't going anywhere. I mean, it certainly would be a better way to go out than just, you know, in complete silence, like in the in an empty forest of, you know, Golden One Center there in Sacramento. So I guess why not?
Yeah. Yeah, we should be rooting for it. I don't care what you say. So I want to follow up, though. Who do you think Tyreke could help? Because I've been playing this out. And I think, I mean, I'm higher on him than you are. You're like hardwired to loathe what Tyreke Evans represents in the NBA. But I think if you put him on Boston's second unit, which is a bench that has really struggled to score, especially lately, but really all year, like that could work. And he's on a super cheap deal. I don't know. I think somebody should make a play for him.
Well, I do like that fit better just because you see at times they're just lacking creators, you know, and
yeah,
especially when you're against that elite level competition. Like that Celtics Warriors game was really fun to watch all around. The Kyrie Steph stuff back and forth was fantastic, but there was definitely moments where you were like, can anyone else on Boston like get anything done off the dribble or kind of create or like get stuff going here? It got a little bit predictable, I thought, from the Celtics side. And then you know, some of their wings were just sort of getting swallowed up by KD and Golden State's defense. You put Tyreke in there as just sort of a battering ram in the second unit, and you give him very clear instructions, and you surround him with players who are spacing so that he's got a lot of room to work one-on-one. I think that could work out okay. Again, I'm not sure that's like the world's biggest move, but hey, why not?
Moving on here, Tommy says, Dr. Golliver, can you please diagnose the issues with the Charlotte Hornets? What is wrong with us? All right. First of all, we're not going to ever call Ben Dr. Golliver. His ego is big enough. He has three nicknames. Ranger Rick. that's another one. Captain Accountability. Grandpa Golliver. He is not Dr. Golliver. But as far as the Hornets issues, like everybody is an issue down there. I don't really know what the answer is. And so we have a second question here concerning the Hornets. Stav says, is Rich Cho the nicest bloke in the world or something? Why does he never cop shit for doing such a terrible job in Charlotte? It's like a shit contract factory. It's probably my favorite email we've gotten over the last couple of weeks. So explain it. Explain what's happening with the Hornets. Rich Cho, take it whatever direction you want.
Well, first, I want to make it clear, no one has ever emailed in to say Dr. Sharp. And I started thinking about like, okay, Dr.
Yeah, maybe
Sharp.
It's just jealousy on my part. Sorry.
Do you know who I picture when I think Dr. Sharp? It's Dr. Nick from The Simpsons. Anyway, the Hornets. They have been very, very bad in close games this year. They're one of these teams where a point differential suggests that they are better than their record, but their record is terrible. So they have this huge stench over them of like, oh, we're not going anywhere. I think right now they're 9-18 in clutch situations, which is horrible. I mean, it's 27th out of 30. And that is a huge contributing factor to you know, their current record and why they're so far out of the postseason chase. In terms of like when you look at their players, Batum has been really rough. I mean, you certainly yes. circle him. Terrible shooting, real disappointment. But when you actually look at their starting groups, you know, their main lineups actually work pretty well, even ones that include Batum. Basically, like any combination of Kemba, MKG, Marvin Williams, Dwight, Batum, and Lamb, like any five of those guys, they work well, pretty well together. So that says the bench is letting them down in a big way. And I think you're going to laugh, but you know the Cody Zeller injury, you know for sure, you know not getting a lot of minutes out of him yeah. was a game changer here for two seasons in a row, and that's unfortunate. In terms of what they should do, and Rich Cho as you know being a nice guy or whatever that emailer said, Rich Cho is a nice guy. I'm sure people have heard about his food blog.
Yes.
But I think
he
got
himself... There's a great write-up in The New Yorker about his food blog, and he does seem like a very cool guy.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. I go back to Portland days with him a little bit. He got stuck in a situation where ownership had a very clear mandate, which is we're trying to make the playoffs. We're trying to be competitive. We're sick of being like the 9-win Charlotte Bobcats, you know, from that era. And so they had a series of decisions where do we pay guys? Do we not pay guys? And if they didn't pay them, they weren't going to be able to replace them. And so therefore, they were going to fall well outside the postseason picture. So you can see, that's Marvin Williams. That's MKG. That's Seller. That's Batum. You know, right down the list. And so I think a lot of what people are judging Rich Cho right now is just based on Michael Jordan's viewpoint that he wants to be a playoff team basically no matter what. And they were also building around Kemba Walker's sort of timeline, which said, hey, load up with veterans and try to put a winning team around them. Unfortunately, those guys that I named, most of them aren't that good, or they have major limitations, whether it's health or holes in their game that have kind of held them back. And so their margin for error has been pretty small. And when things start to go wrong, they go south pretty quickly. I'm not sure exactly how you fix this, though, you know, going forward for the Hornets. I mean, I do see the logic to a Kemba trade. I mean, that would be a pretty full, you know, hitting of the reset button. That'd be hard to sell to MJ. You know, Cho is a very analytical thinker. He does what he believes is best for the long-term future of his teams, you know, in almost every situation. The question is just, does his conclusion get through Michael's head, and do they see eye to eye on those things?
Yeah, I think the answer to the second question about Rich Cho is that he is given a pretty significant benefit of the doubt because of Jordan's involvement in that team. And so people who wonder about the state of the Hornets or jump to criticize them pretty much are just blaming Jordan. And so it's hard to know how much influence Cho has really had. I will say...
Well, hey, look, that's fair, though, because remember, he's had previous GMs who just put their own sons on the team. You know, like that was a real thing there for a while, where like Higgins and these other guys are just like hiring their sons and putting them on the roster. And it's like, look, Rich Cho's at least not doing that. I mean, at least he's blogging about food, you know?
It's also interesting to think about the Hornets because they had that 1 year when I believe they were still the Bobcats, where they tanked their ass off to try to get Anthony Davis. And they were one pick off, and then it was like they had to settle for MKG, and then they didn't really, like, it didn't affect their planning at all. They were like, okay, well, this was the year that we tanked, and now it's time to start getting good. And it shows you why the process exists. Like, teams like the Hornets are why the Sixers plan made sense, at least in the abstract. The last thought I had about the Hornets is that Nick Batum's contract makes me feel so much better. Every time I start to complain about Otto Porter, Nick Batum makes me feel better. It's like that's the worst case scenario for a max deal is a guy who just suddenly, like, his game, he's not unplayable, but he's just like 50% of what he was. And I can't imagine how frustrating that would be for New Orleans or for Charlotte.
Yeah, and for Cho in particular, because he knew him very well from Portland. He understood Batum kind of wanted more. There was always those inconsistency issues. You talk yourself into saying, hey, we're going to bring him here, make him the guy. You get like one or two good seasons out of him, and then just, you know, career goes to nothing, and you're stuck holding the bag. I mean, that is why the GMs, you know, that's why they get paid the big bucks, and that's why they often, you know, take the bullets when things don't go well.
Yeah. From GM to coaches, Nate says, which current NBA players would make great coaches later on in their careers? I've heard people talk recently about how LeBron should coach at some point, but he'll probably still be playing in 20 years. What did you think of this? Did you have any answers?
You go first. I mean, this is always a tricky one where you're just kind of like stereotyping based on a guy's personality or his demeanor, and it gets a little dicey. I mean, what did you think?
Okay, so I had a couple nominations here. Number one, if you look around the league, the ex-players are usually like scrappy point guards. And I think TJ McConnell definitely has the look of somebody who's going to be a coach in like 15 or 20 years. He just does. I would also nominate Malcolm Brogdon as someone who is really smart and could easily, like, TJ McConnell seems like a basketball lifer, and Malcolm Brogdon could easily like go into politics or something. So maybe coaching is beneath him.
Yeah, but he's got a higher ceiling, I think.
Yeah, probably. But then I basically scrappy point guards. I threw out Ramon Sessions, who's not even particularly scrappy, but he's just random enough to maybe pop up in 5 years as a coach. And then the one thing I did think seriously about is the Warriors have a couple different guys who could be coaches. David West is another guy who is so smart that coaching is probably beneath him. But I would nominate David West and Sean Livingston as guys who could potentially transition down the line. And then of the four stars they have, the one guy who I think could be pretty solid as a coach is Klay Thompson. Like he's just checked out enough to, and just sort of like even keel no matter what happens, that I think he could be pretty solid one day.
Well, that's interesting because of all the superstars in the league who would make the best coach, I actually could see Steph Curry being the best. The reason why I say that, it's like Steve Kerr 2.0.
It might be too easy. Yeah, it is. It's definitely Kerr 2.0.
And like, he's not that super demanding guy who just wears on all the players. Like, he's never going to scream profanities at Kwame Brown like Mike, you know, like, or he's not going to like come in and suck all the oxygen out of a room like obviously LeBron James would if he was a coach. He would have that Zen mentality where he could see lineup combinations and kind of put players in position for success. I mean, I think that could actually work in terms of a superstar guy. You mentioned the point guards and kind of the scrappy point guard model. I mean, what about Mike Conley? Really friendly guy, good personality, been around the league. Everyone swears by him. I could see him, a very high IQ. I mean, just master of the pick and roll, understand spacing. You know, really got a lot of good contributions from some kind of kooky lineups down there in Memphis for years. I could see him being a really good coach.
One thing I wonder about with Conley, though, is like, if you've made $200 million in your life, do you really want to go be a coach somewhere and like have to answer to people who ostensibly have more power than you?
Well, that it's a great question, not just about Conley, but about this entire generation of guys, because this is when we've seen the explosion of salaries, right? So it's one thing if KG goes and hangs out on Area 21 and he cashes those checks and he's just having a good time shooting hoops with Rasheed Wallace and calling it a night, you know, because he's got nothing else to do. That's quite a bit different than like, you know, looking at game film for 16 hours a day and really grinding out. It takes a certain personality. And I think that's absolutely a fair question. Going forward, will we see, you know, star or above average players who have been very well compensated decide to go the coaching route, or will they try to push more into front office management, or they go towards the media route just because it's easier money? I think that's an excellent question that you've raised. Another guy I thought of as a potential coach, what about Wesley Matthews? I mean, this guy loves basketball, basketball life. Her dad was in the NBA, grinded back from some very serious injuries as quickly as possible, wants to play every single night, super competitive, smart, intelligent, understands how the game should be played, just is a no excuses, you know, captain accountability type of guy. He's the type of player who actually enjoys playing for Rick Carlisle, right? So from that standpoint, that could work for him too. And then I'm not sure if I've mentioned his name before, but just for the diehards out there, you know, Garrett Temple, I think he's going to most likely be a GM rather than a coach, but he is one of the smartest players in the NBA, one of the smartest people, period, that I've ever spent. And I haven't been around him a ton, but just like spending an hour with him on draft night was enough to be like, wow, this guy's you know, super intellectual, smart, savvy, and all the other things. I think he's going to be a GM one day. I just always like to throw him a little love.
Yeah, Garrett Temple is very cool, very smart. I loved him when he was in DC, and that's a great call. I don't have any takes on Wes Matthews. That's a deep Portland cut, a deep captain accountability cut, but sure. And Mike Conley, if I made $200 million, I would go like buy an island and just never talk to anyone again in the NBA. But we'll see. Let's move on, though. A couple more questions here. Reed says, longtime listener and recent five-star reviewer, I was listening to Ben put Duncan and Manu on his all-time lineup of foreign players, and it got me thinking. I can't recall Ben praising Tony Parker on previous pods the same way that he's praised Tim and Manu. I'm not looking for generic praise because I'm not a Spurs fan and I have no connection to Tony Parker. I'm just curious if there's something that puts him that puts Tony Parker a level below Manu. I looked back and saw that Parker was number 4 on the 2014 top 100 list. How does Golliver feel Tony's career compares to the other Spurs stars? What do you think?
Great and very thoughtful question, Reed. First of all, I'm going to blame you, Andrew, because when we used to do these podcasts and I would have to like form my teams, I would try to form the absolute best team. So I would consult like career win shares. I would look at all these different metrics of who's won all NBA and All-Star and all these things to try to make the absolute best team. But you kind of came along and you're using more emotion and you're trying to pull that kind of strand out of me. And so that's why I wound up settling with Manu on my all-time international team, along with guys like Drazen, Giannis, Duncan, and Olajuwon, just because Manu's emotional pull is through the roof. And I think everyone would agree in terms of like, who are you drawn to more as a player? 99 out of 100 are going to say Manu over Parker. Now, in terms of pure accomplishments on the NBA level, Parker's had a better career. There's no doubt about it. He's had a bunch of different phases of his career. His peak, he was much, much higher among his peers than most people realize. Multiple years MVP candidate, driving force of title teams multiple times. Him and Duncan kind of, sharing that burden, but still, he was playing an absolutely central role. I think part of the reason why I didn't even think about him on last week's episode is that his drop-off has been so steep and pretty sad. And there's just kind of nowhere to hide him. Like Duncan, late career Duncan could still be amazing in his role, a star in his role, because all he did was block shots, not foul people, rebound, and make the outlet pass. And then every once in a while, feed somebody with the high-low. Manu is aging so gracefully because they don't really ask that much of him. Whatever he does, he can do well. But point guards, you can't hide him. He's got every single night, it's a gauntlet in the West. And, I think that's why it was smart for San Antonio to reassess, his role as a starter. I mean, I definitely think it was time to step back from that. And for Parker, it's just like once it goes, it goes. And he just hasn't been the same guy here these last couple of years.
Can I tell you why I included this question today?
Yes.
Because I don't particularly care what you think of Tony Parker, but I got email a Sunday night. I think it came in on Sunday, and I went and looked back to double check that you really ranked Tony Parker as the fourth best player in the NBA at any point in the last 10 years. And I guess this was in September 2013 that you really put him number 4 in the top 100. And honest to God, it made me appreciate you, because it was like, how you mentioned it earlier, like Illmatic, like an artist's first album is often considered their best and most honest work. And that's how I look at the 2014 top 100. Is like, you had Duncan 6, you had Tony Parker number 4. For God's sake, I don't know how you possibly justified it. I didn't even bother to read your entry. But
yeah, it's tough because you weren't following the league back then, So guys like us who have really been stewards and custodians of the NBA through the top 100, we have a little bit different knowledge base. Look, Parker was in his prime. He averaged 20 and 7. He was shooting 52% from the field, and he led a team that nearly beat LeBron James, in the finals, top of his game. I mean, come on.
You're the best. You were keeping it real back then. I feel like now the top 100 has gone too corporate, gone too mainstream, but I really appreciate you and Rob putting Duncan and Tony Parker. Duncan, who was like 35 years old and playing 20 minutes a game at that point in his career, in the top 10. You're just the best. So,
Don't let facts get in the way of what you're saying, because Duncan was not nearly that old at that point, okay? He was basically averaging a double-double, leading the number one defense, all-star, and again, putting them in the finals and unseating LeBron. And as I always mention on this podcast, guaranteeing he was going to beat prime LeBron in the finals and then delivering on it. I don't understand how that's not a top 6 player, unless you just hate the Spurs, man. And I know the Spurs Nation out there has my back. And I know a lot of people who appreciate these traditional greats would understand the kind of legacy these guys were leaving. They'd thank us for recognizing their greatness.
Well, look, that's a project for another day. Maybe we'll save that for August. We can go back and relitigate the 2014 SI Top 100. I'm just proud of you, though. You stayed true to your principles, at least in 2014. I've led you astray since then. But podium here, couple questions. The first is from Matt, who said after our last podcast, I will not stand for the blasphemy Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver are speaking about Travis Scott right now on this podcast. Hashtag open floor. Hashtag you guys are nerds. Hashtag and old. I just want to say that I forgot. Once we finished recording, I remembered that for several years, I thought that Travis Scott was a member of Blink 182 who had broken out solo, and I couldn't figure out why, like, Kanye and all these rappers were working with this guy from Blink 182 and didn't realize that Travis Scott was an entirely different person until seeing him at a Jordan event a couple years ago. So not only are we nerds and old, but it was actually even worse than Matt realized.
No, it was definitely worse than he realized, because when I brought up Travis Scott and how he was at that Jordan party or the Jordan event, the unveiling last week that I was at, but I left that concert so I could podcast with you. Before I made that declaration, I had to do a Wikipedia to find out if his name was Travis Scott or Scott Travis. And apparently there's a Grammy award-winning rock musician whose name is Mark Scott Travis. So I nearly, you know, inverted his name. So it's 100% worse than Matt feared. And look, guys, we are who we are. We keep it real on the podcast. If you want us to pretend like we know pop culture, we could do that too. But that falls in that same generic praise category. I mean, look, we could do it for Travis Scott, couldn't we? Andrew, I mean, I just love the photo that Travis Scott took with Kylie that I saw in Us Weekly last week. I just thought the outfits were perfectly coordinated. Yo. It was just fantastic fashion choice. And then not to mention, he just brings bangers, doesn't he? I mean, everything, it just gets you hype. It puts you in a good mood. And you just have to love that music, don't you?
First of all, I'm not going to allow you to group me in with you. I'm not as much of a cultural neophyte as you are. But nothing, I don't think, all season long, nothing has made me happier than you pronouncing Kylie Jenner's name as if she, it's like Kyrie. I think you said Kylie Jenner. That's amazing. And yes, that solid generic praise, solid Us Weekly praise there. I don't listen to rap that's been released like in the current decade, and I've probably missing out on some good music, but honestly, like 1990 to 2010 is my zone as far as hip-hop is concerned, and I'm not going to apologize for it because a lot of it is just shitty, so it is what it is.
Yeah, I listened to rap when Jay-Z was talking about drug dealing, not 401k plans, so sue me, you know?
I don't know. Corporate Jay-Z is unintentionally hilarious sometimes. All right, Dan says, in the last pod, you guys called out the Bulls for screwing over Scottie Pippen. Couldn't be further from the truth. Pippen screwed himself. He demanded a ridiculously long contract, and Reinsdorf himself cautioned that he would be severely underpaid by the end of it. But Scottie wanted security and wanted to sign the deal. Okay, that is 100% true. I screwed that up. I think the confusion was that the Bulls were not even willing to negotiate on an extension because they had tied up some of their money for Kukoc in like 1991 or 92. But it's true that when he eventually signed that deal, it was him kind of demanding this long-term deal, which would prove to be a massive underpay for the Bulls. And it worked out. It's one of the reasons they were able to keep that dynasty going.
No doubt. Hey, you know, last week we had that breaking news out of Milwaukee with Jason Kidd getting fired and on the podcast. And we have more breaking news out of Milwaukee today, right now, right here. Do you know what it is, Andrew?
No, I'm trying to think of what it could be. I don't know. Did they fire Kidd again?
No, they didn't. Chris Middleton is your Eastern Conference Player of the Week. So deserved. I'm so excited for him. Congratulations, Chris. It's been a phenomenal season. You don't get nearly enough credit. And it's great to see you turn it around so quickly after a kid was out the door. I'm sure that's not a coincidence.
Great. Well, you know what? Let's close it off there. That's a perfect way to end it. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for Chris. And yeah, let's check back in on Friday. I imagine, when do you think moves are going to start to happen around the league here?
Well, it seems like it's getting there. I don't know if we're too far away, but I don't have a great crystal ball. So, you know, when they happen, we'll respond and we'll be all over it. In the meantime, send in all of your trade deadline related questions, All-Star Weekend related questions, Scott Travis and Travis Scott related questions, Kylie and Kyrie questions to openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Don't forget, 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. And go ahead and write Team Sharp if you're pro free speech in your review. And also, one final plug for Rob Mahoney's Breakaway podcast. It's phenomenal. You will not be disappointed. Andrew, until later this week, I'll talk to you.
All right, man. Talk to you soon.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.